was like the apple of his eye. It killed him, what happened to me. Killed him.
You live around here? Lyle was freaking her out. His intensity was laser-like.
We've lost touch, she said, already looking around the bar for the next score. I think it was all too much for him.
Your family sued the school district, didn't they? Lyle said, leaning in, getting greedy. I moved my stool so I blocked him off a bit, hoping he'd get the idea.
Hell yeah! They needed to be sued. Letting someone like that work there? Letting a little girl get molested right under their noses? I came from a really good family.
Lyle cut her off. Do you mind if I ask, with the settlement, how did you end up, here? The customer at the table was now turned around entirely in his chair, watching us, belligerent.
My family had some business setbacks. The money's been gone a long time. It's not like it's a bad thing, working here. People always think that. It's not. It's empowering. It's fun. It makes people happy. How many people can say all that about their jobs? It's not like I'm a whore.
I frowned before I could help myself, looked in the direction of the truck park.
That? Chrissy fake whispered. I was just getting a hold of a little something for tonight. I wasn't... Oh, God, no. Some girls do, but I don't. There's some poor girl, 16 years old, works it with her mom. I try to look out for her. Colleen. I keep thinking I should call child services on her or something. Who do you even call for something like that?
Chrissy asked it with all the concern of finding a new gynecologist. Can we get your dad's address? Lyle asked. Chrissy stood up, about 20 minutes after I would have.
I told you, we're not in touch, she said.
Lyle started to say something when I turned to him, poked a finger toward his chest, and mouthed, shut up. He opened his mouth, shut it, looked at the girl on stage, who was now pantomiming fucking the floor, and walked out the door. It was too late, though. Chrissy was already saying she had to go meet someone. As I was settling up with the bartender, she asked me if she could borrow $20.
I'll buy Colleen some dinner with it, she lied.
Then she quickly changed it to 50.
I just haven't cashed my work check yet. I will totally pay you back.
She made an elaborate play out of getting a sheet of paper and pen for me, told me to write down my address, and she'd totally, totally mail me the money. I mentally put the cash on Lyle's tab, forked it over to Chrissy, her counting it in front of me like I might shortchange her. She opened the big maw of her purse and a child's sippy cup rolled out onto the floor. Leave it, she waved at me when I bent to pick it up, and so I left it. Then I took the greasy scrap of paper and wrote down my address and my name. Libby Day. My name is Libby Day, you lying whore.
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 1:50 p.m. Patty wondered how many hours she and Diane had spent rumbling around in cars together. 1,000? 2,000? Maybe if you added it all up, a sum total of 2 years put end to end, the way mattress companies always did. You spend a third of your life asleep, why not do it on a comfort cush? 8 years standing in lines, they say. 6 years peeing. Put like that, life was grim. 2 years waiting in the doctor's office, but a total of 3 hours watching Debbie at breakfast laughing until milk started dribbling down her chin. 2 weeks eating soppy pancakes her girls made for her, the middle still sour with batter. Only 1 hour staring in amazement as Ben unconsciously tucked his baseball cap behind his ears in a gesture mirror perfect to what his grandpa did. His grandpa dead when Ben was just a baby. 6 years of hauling manure, though. 3 years of ducking calls from bill collectors. Maybe a month of having sex. Maybe a day of having good sex. She'd slept with three men in her life. Her gentle high school boyfriend. Runner, the hotshot who stole her from her gentle high school boyfriend and left her with four wonderful children. And a guy she dated for a few months somewhere in the years after Runner left. They'd slept together three times with the kids at home. It always ended awkwardly. Ben, sulky and possessive at age 11, would park himself in the kitchen so he could glower at them as they left her bedroom in the morning. Patty worrying about the guy's semen on her. That smell, so stark and embarrassing with your children still in their pajamas. It was clearly not going to work from the start. And she'd never gotten the courage up to try again. Libby would graduate from high school in 11 years. So maybe then. She'd be 43, which was right when women were supposed to peak sexually. Or something. Maybe it was menopause. "We heading to the school?" Diane asked, and Patty pulled out of her three-second trance to remember their horrible errand. Their mission. To find her son and... what? Hide him away till this blew over? Drive him to the little girl's house and straighten it all out? In family movies, the mom always caught the son stealing, and she'd march him back over to the drugstore and get him to hand over the candy on a shaky palm and beg forgiveness. She knew Ben shoplifted some. Before he started locking his door, she'd occasionally find strange, pocket-sized items in his room. A candle, batteries, a plastic packet of toy soldiers. She'd never said anything, which was horrible. Part of her didn't want to deal with it. Drive all the way into town and talk to some kid who got paid minimum wage and didn't care anyway. And the other part, even worse, thought, why the hell not? The boy had so little. Why not keep pretending this was something a friend gave him? Let him have this stolen trifle, a pebble plunk of a wrongdoing in the grand scheme. No, he wouldn't go to the school. He only works Sundays.
Well, where?
They came to a stoplight, swaying on a line like laundry. The road dead-ended onto the pasture of a land-rich family that lived in Colorado. Turn right and they were heading to Kinnicky proper, the town, the school. Turn left and they were going deeper into Kansas, all farmland where Ben's two friends lived. Those shy future farmers of America who couldn't bear to ask for Ben when she picked up the phone. Take a left. We'll go see the Muellers.
He still hangs around with them? That's good. No one could think those boys would do anything weird.
Oh, because Ben would? Diane sighed and turned left.
I'm on your side, P.
The Mueller brothers had dressed as farmers for Halloween every year since birth, their parents driving them into Kinnicky in the same wide-body truck. The boys deposited on Bullhart Avenue for trick-or-treating in their tiny John Deere baseball caps and overalls while the parents drank coffee at the diner. The Mueller brothers, like their parents, talked only about alfalfa and wheat and weather, and went to church on Sunday, where they prayed for things that were probably crop-related. The Muellers were good people with no imagination, with personalities so tied to the land, even their skin seemed to take on the ridges and furrows of Kansas. I know. Patty reached to put her hand on Diane's, just as Diane shifted gears, so her hand hung just above her sister's, and then went back to her lap.
Oh, you bleeping jerk,
Diane said to a car ahead of her, rolling along at 20 miles an hour and deliberately going slower as Diane closed in on the bumper. She swerved up to pass them, and Patty stared rigidly ahead, even though she could feel the driver's face on her, a murky moon in her peripheral. Who was this person? Had they heard the news? Is that why they were staring? Maybe even pointing?
There's the woman who raised that boy.
The day boy. 100 phones were rattling this morning if Diane had heard last night. At home, her 3 girls were probably sitting in front of the TV, turning from cartoons to the blaring telephone, which they'd been told to pick up in case Ben called. They seemed unlikely to follow that instruction. They were strung out with the fear of the morning. If anyone dropped by, they'd find 3 unattended, teary kids, age 10 and under, huddled on the living room floor, cringing at the noise.
"Maybe one of us should have stayed home, in case," Patty said.
"You're not going anywhere by yourself while this is going on, and I don't know where to go. This is the right thing. Michelle's a big girl. I watched you when I was younger than her."
But that was back when people still did that, Patty thought. Back when people went out for a whole night and left the kids on their own, and no one thought anything of it. In the 50s and 60s, out on that quiet old prairie where nothing ever happened. Now, little girls weren't supposed to ride bikes alone or go anywhere in groups of less than 3. Patty had attended a party thrown by one of Diane's work friends, like a Tupperware party, but with rape whistles and mace instead of wholesome plastic containers. She'd made a joke about what kind of lunatic would drive all the way out to Kinnickee to attack someone. A blonde woman she'd just met looked up from her new pepper spray keychain and said, "A friend of mine was raped once." Patty had bought several cans of mace out of guilt.
"People think I'm a bad mother. That's why this is happening."
"No one thinks you're a bad mother. You're Superwoman as far as I'm concerned. You keep the farm going, get 4 kids to school every day, and don't drink a gallon of bourbon to do it."
Patty immediately thought of the freezing cold morning 2 weeks ago, when she almost wept with exhaustion. Actually putting on clothes and driving the girls to school seemed an entirely remote possibility. So she let them all stay home and watch 10 hours of soap operas and game shows with her. She made poor Ben ride his bike, shoot him out the door with a promise she'd petition again to get the school bus to come to them next year. "I'm not a good mother."
"Hush."
The Mueller's home was on a decent chunk of land, 400 acres at least. The house was tiny and looked like a buttercup, a swipe of yellow against miles of green winter wheat and snow. It was blowing even harder than before now. The forecast said it would snow through the night, and then would come sudden spring-like temperatures. That promise was wedged in her brain. Sudden spring-like temperatures.
They drove up the skinny, unwelcoming strip of road leading to the house, past a tiller sitting just inside the barn like an animal.
Its hooked blades cast claw shadows on the ground. Diane made a sinus noise she always resorted to when she was uncomfortable. A fake clearing of the throat to fill the silence. Neither of them looked at the other as they got out of the car. Attentive black grackles perched in the trees, cawing continually, ill-natured, noisy birds. One of them flew past, a silvery trail of Christmas tinsel fluttering from its beak. But otherwise, the place was immobile. No motors of any kind, no gates clanking shut, no TV within. Just the silence of the land packed under snow.
"Don't see Ben's bike,"
was all Diane said as they banged the door knocker.
"Could be around back."
Ed answered the door. Jim, Ed, and Ben were all in the same grade. But the brothers weren't twins. One of them had flunked at least once. Maybe twice. She thought it was Ed. He goggled at her for a second, a short kid of only 5'4" or so, but with a man's athletic build. He shoved his hands in his pockets and looked behind him.
"Well, hi, Mrs. Day."
"Hi, Ed. Sorry to bother you on Christmas break."
"No, no problem."
"I'm looking for Ben. Is he here? Have you seen him?"
"Ben?"
He said it in 2 syllables, like he was tickled at the idea.
No. We ain't seen Ben in, well, I don't think we've seen him this whole year, aside from school. He's been hanging around with a different group now.
What group? Asked Diane, and Ed looked at her for the first time.
Well...
She could see Jim's silhouette approaching the door, backlit by the picture window in the kitchen. He lumbered toward them, bigger and wider than his brother.
Can we help you, Mrs. Day?
He nudged his face in, then his torso, slowly moving his brother to the side. The two of them effectively closed off the doorway. It made Patty want to crane her neck around them and peek inside.
I was just asking Ed if you two'd seen Ben today, and he said you hadn't been seeing much of him this whole school year.
No. Wish you'd phoned. Could have saved you some time.
We just need to find him soon. You have any idea where we can find him? It's sort of a family emergency. Diane interrupted.
No, said Jim again. Wish we could help.
You can't give us even a name of who he spends time with? Surely you must know that. Ed had swung to the background now, so he was calling from the shadow of the living room.
Tell her to phone 1-800-DEVILS-OR-US, he cackled.
What?
Nothing.
Jim looked at the doorknob in his hand, debating whether to start closing it.
Jim, can you help us? Please.
Patty murmured.
Please.
The boy frowned, tapped the point of a cowboy boot against the floor like a ballerina, refused to raise his eyes.
He hangs out with, like, the devil crowd.
What does that mean?
Some older guy heads it. I don't know his name. They do a lot of drugs, peyote or whatever, and kill cows and stuff. That's just what I heard. They don't go to our school, the kids in it. Except for Ben, I guess.
Well, you must know the name of someone, Patty coaxed.
I really don't, Mrs. Day. We steer clear of that stuff. I'm sorry. We tried to stay friends with Ben, but... We go to church here. My parents, they run a tight ship. I'm real sorry.
He looked at the ground and stopped talking, and Patty couldn't think of anything else to ask.
Okay, Jim. Thanks.
He shut the door, and before they could turn around, from inside the house they heard a bellow.
Asshole! Why do you gotta say that?
Followed by a heavy bang against the wall.
Libby Day, now. Back in the car, Lyle said only three words.
What a nightmare.
In reply, I said, Chrissy reminded me of me, grasping and anxious, always bundling things aside for future use. That packet of chips. We scroungers always like little packets of food because people give them up with less hassle. Lyle and I drove for 20 minutes without saying much, until finally he said, in his summing-up newscaster voice,
"So obviously she's lying about Ben molesting her. I think she lied to her dad, too. I think Lou Cates went nuts, killed your family, and then later he found out she'd lied. He killed an innocent family for nothing. Hence, his own family disintegrates. Lou Cates disappears, starts drinking."
Hence? I nipped at him.
It's a solid theory, don't you think?
I think you should not come on any more of these interviews. It's embarrassing.
Libby, I'm financing this whole thing.
Well, you're not helping it.
Sorry,
he said, and then we stopped talking. As the lights of Kansas City turned the sky a sick orange in the distance, Lyle said, without looking at me,
"It's a solid theory, though, right?"
"Everything's a theory. That's why it's a mystery," I mimicked him. "Just a great mystery. Who killed the Days?" I proclaimed, brightly. After a few minutes, I said, grudgingly, I think it's an okay theory. I think we should look at Runner, too.
Fine by me. Although I'm still going to track down Luke Cates.
Be my guest. I dropped him back outside Sarah's, not offering to take him home, Lyle standing on the curb like a kid, baffled that his parents can really bear leaving him at camp. I got home late and cranky and anxious to count my money. I'd made $1,000 so far from the Kill Club, with another $500 that Lyle owed me for Chrissy, even though Chrissy clearly would have talked to anybody. But even as I thought that, I knew it wasn't true. None of those Kill Club misfits could have made that work with Chrissy, I thought. She talked to me because we had the same chemicals in our blood. Shame, anger, greed, unjustified nostalgia. I'd earned my money, I thought, resentful for no reason. Lyle seemed completely fine with paying me. That's what I did, though. I had angry, defensive conversations in my head, got mad at things that hadn't even happened yet. Yet. I'd earned my money. Now I felt calmer. And if I heard from Runner, if I talked to Runner, I'd earn a lot more money and be set for a good 4 months. If I lived very still. Make that 5 months. By the time I got home, Lyle had already left a message saying some local kill creeps wanted to have a swap meet, buy some of my family's memorabilia. Magda would host if I was interested. Magda, the cave troll who'd drawn devil horns on my photo. Yes, Magda, I would love to be a guest in your home. Where do you keep your silver again? I clicked off the answering machine, which I'd stolen from a roommate 2 moves ago. I thought of Chrissy, and knew her house was probably filled with other people's crap, too. I had a stolen answering machine, a nearly full set of pocketed restaurant silverware, and a half dozen salt and pepper shakers, including the new pair from Tim Clark's that I couldn't manage to transfer from the hall table to the kitchen. In one corner of my living room, by my old TV set, is a box with more than 100 small bottles of lotion I've swiped. I keep them because I like to look at the lotions all together, pink and purple and green. I know this would look crazy to anyone who came to my home, but no one does, and I like them too much to get rid of them. My mom's hands were always rough and dry. She was constantly oiling them, to no avail. It was one of our favorite ways to tease her.
Oh, Mom, don't touch! You're like an alligator!
The church we fitfully attended kept lotion in the women's room that she said smelled like roses. We'd all take turns squirting and sniffing our hands, complimenting each other on our ladylike scent. No phone call from Diane. She'd have gotten my message by now, and she hadn't called. That seemed strange. Diane always made it easy for me to apologize. Even after this latest round of silent treatment, 6 years. Guess I should have autographed my book for her. I turned around to the other set of boxes, the under-the-stairs boxes that had grown more ominous the more I let myself think about the murders. It's just stuff, I told myself. It cannot hurt you. When I was 14, I thought a lot about killing myself. It's a hobby today, but at age 14, it was a vocation. On a September morning, just after school started, I'd gotten Diane's .44 Magnum and held it, baby-like, in my lap for hours. What an indulgence it would be to just blow off my head, all my mean spirits disappearing with a gun blast, like blowing a seedy dandelion apart. But I thought about Diane and her coming home to my small torso and a red wall, and I couldn't do it. It's probably why I was so hateful to her. She kept me from what I wanted the most. I just couldn't do it to her, though. So I made a bargain with myself. If I still feel this bad on February 1st, I will kill myself. And it was just as bad on February 1st. But again, I made the bargain. If it's this bad May 1st, I'll do it. And so on. I'm still here. I looked at the boxes and made a quieter kind of bargain. If I can't stand doing this anymore in 20 minutes, I'll burn the whole lot. The first box came apart easily, one side collapsing as soon as I pulled off the tape. Inside, at the top of the pile, was a concert t-shirt for the police that was my mom's, food-stained and extremely soft. 18 minutes. Below that was a rubber-banded bunch of notebooks, all Debbie's. I flipped through random pages. Harry S. Truman was the 33rd American president and from Missouri. The heart is the pump of the body. It keeps blood going all over the body. Under that was a pile of notes from Michelle to me, from me to Debbie, from Debbie to Michelle. Sifting through notes, I plucked out a birthday card with an ice cream sundae on the front, its cherry made with red sequins. "Dear Debbie," wrote my mom in her cramped handwriting, "we are so lucky to have such a sweet, kind, helpful girl in our family. You are my cherry on top, Mom." She never wrote Mommy, I thought. We never called her that, even as kids. I want my mommy, I thought. We never said that. I want my mom. I felt something loosen in me that shouldn't have loosened. A stitch come undone. 14 minutes. I rummaged through more notes, putting the boring, inane ones aside for the kill club. Missing my sisters, laughing at some of them, the strange worries we had, the coded messages, the primitive drawings, the lists of people we liked and didn't like. I'd forgotten we were tight, the day girls. I wouldn't have said we were, but now, studying our writings like a spinster anthropologist, I realized it was true. 11 minutes. Here were Michelle's diaries, all rubber-banded together in a faux leathery bundle. Every year she got 2 for Christmas. She needed twice as many as a normal girl. She'd always start the new one right there, while we were still under the tree, chronicling every gift each of us got, keeping score. I flipped open one from 1983 and remembered what a rotten busybody Michelle was, even at age 9. The day's entry talked about how she heard her favorite teacher, Mrs. Birdall, saying dirty things to a man on the phone in the teacher's lounge, and Miss Birdall wasn't even married. Michelle wondered if she confronted her, maybe Miss Birdall would bring her something nice for lunch. Apparently Miss Birdall had once given Michelle half her jelly donut, which had left Michelle permanently fixated on Miss Birdall and her brown paper bags. Teachers were usually reliable for half a sandwich or a piece of fruit if you stared at them long enough. You just couldn't do it too much, or you'd get a note sent home, and Mom would cry. Michelle's diaries were filled with drama, an innuendo of a very grade school level. At recess, Mr. McNanny smoked just outside the boys' locker room and then used breath spray. Breath spray underlined several times, so no one would know. Mrs. Jokep from church was drinking in her car, and when Michelle asked Mrs. Jokep if she had the flu, since why was she drinking from that bottle, Mrs. Jokep laughed and gave her $20 for Girl Scout cookies, even though Michelle wasn't a Girl Scout. Hell, she even wrote things about me. She knew, for instance, I lied to Mom about punching Jessica O'Donnell. This was true. I gave the poor girl a black eye, but swore to my mom she fell off a swing. "Libby told me the devil made her do it," Michelle wrote. "Think I should tell Mom?" I closed the book on 1983, browsed through 1982 and 1984. The diary for the second half of 1984 I read carefully in case Michelle said anything noteworthy about Ben. Not much, except repeated claims that he was a big jerk and no one liked him. I wondered if the cops had had the same idea. I pictured some poor rookie eating Chinese food at midnight while reading about how Michelle's best friend got her period. 9 minutes. More birthday cards and letters, and then I dug up a note that was folded more expertly than the rest, origamied so it looked almost phallic, which I supposed was the intention, as the word stud was written at the top. I opened it up and read the rounded, girlish writing. 11-5-84. Dear Stud, I'm in biology, and I'm fingering myself under the desk. I'm so hot for you. Can you picture my pussy? It's still nice and red from you. Come over to my house after school today, okay? I want to jump your bones. I'm so horny, even now. I wish you'd just live with me whenever my parents are gone. Your mom won't know. She's so spacey. Why would you stay at home when you could come be with me? Get some balls and tell your mom to go to hell. I'd hate for you to come for a visit one day and find me getting some action somewhere else. JK. Oh, I want to come so much. Meet me at my car after school. I'll park over on Passel Street. See you soon, Deandra. Ben had not had a girlfriend. He hadn't. Not a single person, including Ben, had ever said so. The name didn't even sound familiar. At the bottom of the box was a stack of our school yearbooks, from 1975, when Ben started school, to 1990, when Diane sent me away the first time. I opened the yearbook from 1984 to 1985 and scanned Ben's class. No Deandra, but a photo of Ben that hurt. Sloped shoulders, a loose half-mullet, and an Oxford shirt that he always wore on special occasions. I pictured him, back home, putting it on for picture day, practicing in the mirror how he'd smile. In September 1984, he was still wearing shirts my mom bought him, and by January he was an angry, black-haired kid accused of murder. I skimmed through the class above Ben's, jerking occasionally as I hit Diane's and Dina's, but no Deandra. Then to the class above that, about to give up, when there she was, Deandra Wurtzner, worst name ever, and I pulled my finger over the row, expecting to find a lunch lady in the making, someone coarse and mustached, and instead found a pretty, plump-cheeked girl with a fountain of dark spiral curls. She had small features, which she overplayed with heavy makeup, but even in the photo, she popped off the page. Something in the deep-set eyes, a daring, with her lips parted so you could see pointy puppy teeth. I pulled out the yearbook for the previous year, and she was gone. I pulled out the yearbook for the following year, and she was gone.
Ben Day, January 2, 1985, 3:10 p.m. Trey's truck smelled like weed, sweat socks, and sweet wine cooler that Deandra had probably spilled. Deandra tended to pass out while still holding a bottle in her hand. It was her preferred way to drink, to do it till it knocked her out, that last sip nearby just in case. The truck was littered with old fast food wrappers, fish hooks, a penthouse, and on the fuzzy mat at Ben's feet, a crate of cartons labeled Mexican jumping beans, each box featuring a little bean wearing a sombrero, swooshes at its feet to make it look like it was bouncing. "Try one," Trey said, motioning at it. "Nah, isn't that supposed to be bugs or something?" "Yeah, they're like beetle larvae," Trey said, and gave his jackhammer laugh. "Great, thanks, that's cool." "Aw, shit, man, I'm just fucking with you, lighten up." They pulled into a 7-Eleven. Trey waving to the Mexican guy behind the counter. "Now there's a bean for you." Loading Ben up with a case of Beast, some microwave nachos that Deandra always whined for, and a fistful of beef jerky, which Trey held in his hand like a bouquet. The guy smiled at Trey, made an ululating Indian war sound. Trey crossed his arms in front of his chest and pretended to do a hat dance. "Just ring me up, Jose." The guy didn't say anything else, and Trey left him the change, which was a good $3. Ben kept thinking about that on the drive to Deandra's. That most of this world was filled with people like Trey, who'd just leave behind $3 without even thinking of it. Like Deandra. A few months back, at the very hot end of September, Deandra ended up having to babysit two of her cousins, or step-half-cousins, or something, and she and Ben had driven them to a water park near the Nebraska border. She'd been driving her mom's Mustang for a month. She was bored with her own car, and the back seat was filled with things they'd brought. things it would never occur to Ben to own. 3 different kinds of sunscreen, beach towels, squirt bottles, rafts, inflatable rings, beach balls, pails. The kids were small, like 6 or 7 years old, and they were jammed back there with all that crap, the inflatable rafts making a woogie, woogie sound every time they moved. And somewhere near Lebanon, the kids rolled down the window, giggling, the rafts making more and more noise, like they were climaxing in some air mattress mating ritual, and Ben realized what the kids were giggling about. They were scraping all the change Deandra left in the back seat, on the floor, in the crevices. She just tossed any change she had back there, and the kids were throwing it by the handful out the window so they could watch it scatter like sparks. And not just pennies. A lot of it was quarters. Ben thought that was how you could tell the difference between most people. It wasn't, I'm a dog person and I'm a cat person, or I'm a Chiefs fan and I'm a Broncos guy. It was whether you cared about quarters. To him, 4 quarters was a dollar. A stack of quarters was lunch. The amount of quarters those little shits threw out the window that day could have bought him half a pair of jeans. He kept asking the kids to stop, telling them it was dangerous, illegal. They could get a ticket. They needed to sit down and face forward. The kids laughed, and Deandra howled. Ben won't get his allowance this week if you keep taking his change. And he realized he'd been found out. He hadn't been as quick-wristed as he'd thought. Deandra knew he scraped after her leftover coins. He felt like a girl whose dress just shot up in the wind. And he wondered what that said about her, seeing her boyfriend scrape around for change and saying nothing. Did that make her nice? Or mean? Trey rolled up full speed to Deandra's house, a giant beige box surrounded by a chain-link fence to keep Deandra's pit bulls from killing the mailman. She had 3 pits, one a white sack of muscles with giant balls and crazy eyes that Ben disliked even more than the other two. She let them in the house when her parents were gone, and they jumped on tables and crapped all over the floor. Deandra didn't clean it up, just sprayed bathroom air freshener on all the shit-entwined carpet threads. That nice blue rug in the rec room, a dusty violet, Deandra called it, was now a landmine of ground-in dumps. Ben tried not to care. It wasn't his business, as Deandra was happy to remind him. The back door was open, even though it was freezing, and the pit bulls were running in and out like some sort of magic act. No pit bull. 1 pit bull. 2 pit bulls in the yard. 3. 3 pit bulls in the yard, prancing around in rough circles, then shooting back inside. They looked like birds in flight, teasing and nipping at each other in formation. "I hate those fucking dogs," Trey groaned, pulled to a stop. "She spoils them." The dogs launched into a round of attack barking as Ben and Trey walked toward the front of the house, the animals trailing them obsessively along the fence, snouts and paws poking through the gaps, barking, barking, barking. The front door was open too, the heat pouring out. They passed through the pink-papered entryway, Ben unable to resist shutting the door behind him, save some energy, and downstairs, which was Deandra's floor. Deandra was in the rec room, dancing, half-naked in oversized hot pink socks, no pants, and a sweater built for 2, with giant cables that reminded Ben of something a fisherman would wear, not a girl. Then again, all the girls at school wore their shirts big. They called them boyfriend shirts or daddy sweaters. Deandra, of course, had to wear them super big and layered with stuff underneath. A t-shirt hanging down, then some sort of tank top, and a bright striped collar shirt. Ben had once offered Deandra one of his big black sweaters to be a boyfriend sweater, him being her boyfriend. But she'd wrinkled her nose and proclaimed, "That's not the right kind, and there's a hole in it." Like a hole in a shirt was worse than dog shit all over your carpet. Ben was never sure if Deandra knew all sorts of secret rules, private protocols, or if she just made shit up to make him feel like a tool. She was bouncing around to Highway to Hell, the fireplace shooting flames behind her, her cigarette held far away from her new clothes. She had about 12 items, all in plastic wraps or on hangers, or in shiny bags with tissue paper sparking out the top like fire. Also, a couple of shoe boxes, and the tiny packets he knew meant jewelry. When she looked up and saw his black hair, she gave him a giant happy smile and a thumbs up.
Awesome!
And Ben felt a little better, not as stupid.
I told you it'd look good, Benji.
And that was it.
What did you buy, Dio?
Trey asked, rummaging in the bags. He took a drag from her cigarette while she was still holding it, while she was without pants. She caught Ben's look, flipped up the sweater to reveal boxers that weren't his.
It's okay, nerdo.
She came over and kissed him, her smell of grape hairspray and cigarettes hitting him, calming him. He held her gently, the way he did now, loose-armed, and when he felt her tongue hit his, he twitched.
Oh, God, please get over this Deandra's untouchable phase, she snapped.
Unless I'm too old for you. Ben laughed.
You're 17.
If you could hear what I hear, Deandra sang to a silver bell tune, sounding angry, sounding downright pissed.
What's that mean?
Means 17 may just be too old for your taste. Ben didn't know what to say. To pursue something with Deandra when she was in this peekaboo mood only encouraged endless rounds of, no, it's nothing, and I'll tell you later, or don't worry, I can handle it. She pulled her crunchy hair back and danced around for them, a drink now appearing from behind a shoebox. Her neck was lined with purple hickeys he'd given her on Sunday, him draculing into her neck, her demanding more.
Harder, harder, it won't leave a mark if you keep doing it that way. Don't tighten your lips. No tongue, no, harder. Do it harder. How can you not even know how to give a hickey?
And with a furious tight face, she'd grabbed him by the head, turned him sideways, and worked at his neck like a dying fish, the flesh going in out in frantic rhythm. Then she pulled away.
There.
And made him look in the mirror.
Now do me like that.
The result was a march of leeches down her throat, brown and blue and embarrassing to Ben, until he caught Trey staring at them.
Oh no, baby, you're all busted up,
Deandra simpered, finally noticing his cracked head. She licked a finger and started wiping at the blood.
Someone get to you?
Baby fell off his bike, Trey grinned.
Ben hadn't told him he fell off his bike, and he felt a billow of rage at Trey for trying to make fun of him and actually just telling the truth.
Fuck off, Trey.
Hey, said Trey,
his hands shooting up, his eyes going slate.
Someone push you off the bike, baby? Someone try to hurt you?
Deandra petted at him.
You buy anything for Benny Boy so he doesn't have to wear those shitty work jeans for another month? Trey asked.
Of course I did,
she grinned, forgetting Ben's injury, which he'd imagined would take up much more time. She skipped across to a giant red bag and pulled out a pair of black leather pants, thick as cowhide, a striped T-shirt, and a black denim jacket with studs gleaming off it.
Whoa, leather pants! You think you're dating David Lee Roth? Trey cackled.
He'll look good. Go try him on.
She scrunched her nose up at him as he tried to pull her to him.
You ever heard of a shower, Ben? You smell like the cafeteria.
She pushed the clothes into Ben's hands and shuffled him off to the bedroom.
It's a gift, Ben, she yelled after him. You might want to say thank you at some point.
Thank you, he called back.
Take a shower before you put them on, for Christ's sakes.
So she was actually serious. He stunk. He knew he stunk, but hoped no one else could smell him. He walked into the bathroom across from Deandra's bedroom. She had her own dang bathroom, and her parents had their own giant one with two sinks, and dropped his stained clothes into a ball on the bright pink carpet. His crotch was still wet from the bucket spill at his school, his dick shriveled and clammy. The shower felt good, felt relaxing. He and Deandra had sex a lot in this shower, all sudsy and warm. The soap was always there. You didn't have to wash yourself with baby shampoo because your mom couldn't ever fucking get to a store. He dried off, put his boxers back on. He was wearing boxers Deandra had also bought him. The first time they got naked, she'd laughed at his tidy whities till she actually choked on her own spit. He tried to jam the boxers into the taut leather, all snaps and zippers and hooks, and him squirming to haul them up over his ass, which Deandra said was his best feature. The problem was the boxers. They bunched up around his waist when he got the pants on, leaving bulbs in all the wrong places. He yanked the pants back off and kicked his boxers onto the pile of his old clothes, his hackles going up as Trey and Deandra whispered and giggled in the other room. He got back into the pants with nothing underneath, and they clung like a leathery scuba suit. Hot. His ass was already sweating. "Come model for us, stud," Deandra called. He pulled on the T-shirt, walked into her bedroom to check the mirror. The metalhead rockers Deandra loved stared at him from the posters on the walls, even on the ceiling over her bed, giant pointy hair and bodies tightly packed in leather with buckles and belts like alien robot knobs. He didn't think he looked bad. He looked pretty on target. When he walked back into the living room, Deandra squealed and ran to him, jumped into his arms. "I knew it! I knew it! You're a stud!" She flipped his hair back, which was at an awkward, bushy chin length. "You need to keep growing this out, but otherwise you are a stud." Ben looked at Trey, who shrugged. "I'm not the one going to fuck you tonight. Don't look at me." On the floor was a pile of garbage, long, finger-like wrappers from the Slim Jims, and a plastic square with a few streaks of cheese and some nacho crumbs. "You already ate everything?" Ben asked. "Now your turn, Teep Beep," Deandra gushed, taking her hand from Ben's hair. Trey held up a metal-studded shirt that Deandra had bought for him. And why does Trey get something, Ben thought, and slunk back toward the bedroom for his portion of the fashion show. From the hallway came silence, then the pop of a beer, and then laughter, teary, fall-on-the-floor laughter.
"Deandra, come here!"
Deandra was already laughing as she ran back to Trey. Ben left standing, sweating in his new tight pants. Soon she was howling too, and they emerged, faces folded in pure joy, Trey shirtless, holding Ben's boxers.
"Dude, you wearing those ball huggers naked?"
Trey said between laughs, his eyes crazy big.
"Do you know how many dudes have jammed their shit into those pants before you got them? Right now you got 8 different guys' ball sweat on you. Your asshole is pressed right against some other guy's asshole."
They laughed again, Deandra making her poor Ben sound.
"Oh, I think these got some shit stains in them too, Deandra,"
Trey said, peeking inside the boxers.
"You better take care of this little woman."
Deandra plucked them by 2 fingers, walked across the living room, and tossed them in the fire, where they sizzled but didn't catch.
"Even fire can't destroy those things," Trey wheezed. "What are they, Ben? Polyester?"
They plopped down on the couch, Deandra huddling on her side to finish laughing, Trey's head on her haunches. She laughed with her face squeezed shut, then, still reclining, blinked 1 bright blue eye open and assessed him. He was about to walk back to the bathroom to change into his jeans when Deandra leapt up and grabbed him by the hand.
"Oh, sweetie, don't be mad. You look great. You really do. Ignore us." "They are cool, dude. And stewing in another guy's juices might be just what you need to grow a pair, right?"
He started laughing again, but when Deandra didn't join, he went to the fridge and got another beer. Trey still hadn't put on the new shirt. He seemed to like walking around shirtless, sprigs of black chest hair and dark nipples the size of 50-cent pieces, muscles lumping everywhere, a treasure trail down his belly Ben would never get. Ben, pale and small-boned and red-headed, would never look like that. Not 5 years, not 10 years from now. He glanced at Trey, wanting to take a long look, but knowing that was a bad idea. "Come on, Ben, let's not fight," Deandra said, pulling him down on the sofa. "After all the shit I heard today about you, I should be the one who's mad." "See? Now, what does that even mean?" Ben said. "It's like you're talking in code or something. I've had a shit day, and I'm not in the goddamn mood." This is what Deandra did. She baited you, nips and bites here and there, till you were half crazy, and then she was all, "Why are you so upset?" "Aw," she whispered into his ear, "let's not fight. We're together, let's not fight with each other. Come to my room and we'll make up." She had beer breath, and her long fingernails rested on his crotch. She pulled him up. "Trey's here." "Trey won't care," she said, and then louder. "Watch some cable for a little bit, Trey." Trey made an "mmm" sound, didn't even look at them, and flopped headlong on the sofa, his beer spraying like a fountain. Ben was pissed off now, which was always how Deandra seemed to like him. He wanted to ram it into her, make her whine. So as soon as they closed the door, that plywood door Trey could surely hear through, good. Ben reached to grab her, and Deandra turned around and scratched his face, hard, drawing blood. "Deandra, what the hell?" He now had another scrape on his face, and he didn't mind it. "Scar up these big baby cheeks. Do it." Deandra stepped back for a second, opened her mouth, then just pulled him toward her till they fell on her bed, stuffed animals bouncing to lemming deaths on either side. She scratched him again on his neck, and he really wanted to fuck her good then. He was literally seeing red, like they say in cartoons, and she helped him get the pants back off, peeling down like a sunburn, and his dick bouncing right up, hard as it ever had been. She pulled off her sweater, her tits huge, milk blue and soft, and he ripped down her boxers. When he stared at her belly, she turned her back to him and guided him in from behind, her yelling, "Is that it? Is that all you got for me? You can do me harder than that." And him pounding away till his balls ached and his eyes went blind, and then it was over and he was on his back, wondering if he was having a heart attack. He was heaving for air, fighting off that depression that always came to smother him after they had sex, the "that's all" blues. Ben had had sex 22 times now. He was keeping track, all with Deandra, and he'd seen enough TV to know that men were supposed to fall peacefully asleep right afterward. He never did. He got more agitated, actually, like he'd had too much caffeine, snappy and mean. He thought sex was supposed to chill you out, and the during part was good, the coming part was great. But afterward, for about 10 minutes, he felt like crying. He felt like, is this it? The greatest thing in life, the thing men kill for, and this is it? Over in a few minutes, leaving you all gutted and depressed? He could never tell if Deandra liked it or not, came or not. She grunted and screamed, but she never seemed happy afterward. She lay next to him now, her belly up, not touching him, barely breathing. "So, I saw some girls at the mall today," Deandra said next to him. "They say you're fucking little girls at school, like 10-year-olds. "What are you talking about?" Ben said, still dazed. "Do you know a little girl named Chrissy Cates?" Ben tried to keep himself from bolting up. He crossed an arm behind his head, put it back down by his side, crossed it over his chest. Yeah, I guess. She's in that art class I've been helping out after school." "Never told me about no art class," Deandra said. "Nothing to tell. I just did it a few times." "Just did what a few times?" "The art class," Ben said. "Just helping kids. One of my old teachers asked me to." "They say the police want to talk to you. That you did some wrong stuff with some of those girls. Girls who are like your sister's age. Touch them funny. Everyone's calling you a perv." He sat upright, a vision of the basketball team mocking his dark hair, his perviness, trapped in the locker room while they fucked with him till they were bored, drove off in their big-ass trucks.
You think I'm a perv?
I don't know.
You don't know? Why'd you just have sex with me if you think I might be a perv?
I wanted to see if you could still get it up with me. If you would still come a lot. She turned away from him again, her legs pulled up to her chest.
Well, that's pretty fucked up, Deandra.
She said nothing.
So, do you want to hear me say it? I didn't do anything with any girls. I haven't done anything with anyone but you since we started going out. I love you. I don't want to have sex with any little girls, okay?
Silence.
Okay?
Deandra turned part of her face toward him, that single blue eye fixed on him with no emotion.
Shh. The baby's kicking.
Libby Day, now. Lyle was stiff and silent as we drove toward Magda's for our meeting. I wondered if he was judging me and my packet of notes I was going to sell. Nothing I'd decided to part with was particularly interesting. I had 5 birthday cards my mom had given Michelle and Debbie over the years, cheerful, quick notes scrawled at the bottom, and I had a birthday card she'd written to Ben I thought might bring decent money. I felt guilty about all of it, not good at all, but I feared having no money, really feared being broke, and that came before being nice. The note to Ben on the inside of a card for his 12th birthday read, "You are growing up before my eyes. Before I know it, you'll be driving." When I read it, I had to turn it face down and back away, because my mom would be dead before Ben would ever learn how to drive. And Ben would be in prison, would never learn how to drive anyway. Anyway. We drove across the Missouri River, the water not even bothering to glisten in the afternoon sun. What I didn't want was to watch these people read the notes. There was something too intimate about that. Maybe I could leave while they looked at them, assessed them like old candlesticks at a yard sale. Lyle guided me to Magda's, through middle-middle-class neighborhoods where every few houses waved a St. Patrick's Day flag, all bright clovers and leprechauns, just a few days stale. I could feel Lyle fiddling beside me, twitchy as usual, and then he turned toward me, his knees almost punching my stick shift out of gear.
So, he said. So? This meeting, as is often the case with Magda, has turned into something a little different than planned.
What's that mean?
Well, you know she's in that group, the Free Day Society, to get Ben out of prison, and so she's invited a few of those women.
Oh.
No, I said. I pulled the car over to the curb. Listen, you said you wanted to look into Runner. Well, this is it. They will pay us, you, to find him. Ask him some questions, father to daughter.
Daughter to father?
Right. See, I'm running out of money, so this is where the next funding will come from.
So I have to sit here and let them be rude to me, like last time?
No, they can fill you in on the investigation into Runner, bring you up to speed. I mean, you think Ben is innocent now, right?
I had a flash of Ben watching TV. My mom rustling his hair with one hand as she walked past with a load of laundry on her hip, and him smiling but not turning around, waiting till she left the room before he combed his hair back into place. I haven't gotten that far. My keys dangled from the ignition, turning in time to a Billy Joel song on the radio. I switched stations. Fine, let's go, I said. I drove another few blocks. Magda's neighborhood was as cheap as mine, but nicer. Every house had been built shabby, but the owners still found enough pride to slap on a coat of paint every now and then, hang a flag, plant some flowers. The houses reminded me of hopeful, homely girls on a Friday night, hopping bars in spangly tops, packs of them where you assumed at least one might be pretty, but none were, and never would be. And here was Magda's house, the ugliest girl with the most accessories, frantically piled on. The front yard was spiked with lawn ornaments, gnomes bouncing